when spiders come to mind. You might think scary or spooky, dangerous, but not so fast. A recent report from an international group of biologists says there's a lot we get wrong about spiders in our daily lives and even in the news media. Luckily, we have some spider experts in Wisconsin to help separate fact from fiction. Michael Draney is a professor of biology at UW Green Bay. His specialties include the ecology of spiders. I talked to him earlier this fall. Here's a listen. Well, before we get to the fact or fiction thing, I don't know if you know this, Mike. We had you on years ago to talk about what spiders do in the winter. You know that. What you may not know is for years after that, every year around this time, our web article about that would show up on the charts. Like, people kept finding that again. People are really curious about that. Can you remind us, as it gets colder, what do spiders do for the winter?
Yeah. First of all, I have to say why people get so interested. And I think it's because a lot of web spinning spiders are reproducing this time of year. And so they keep getting bigger and bigger until around Halloween. But they also put their webs higher and higher up in the landscape. And so by Halloween, there's big spiders right in your face. So anyway, how do they get through the winter? Obviously, they're not going to be migrating like birds. So they all are surviving the winter somehow right here in Wisconsin. Amazingly, all the ones we've looked at survive as spiders. That is, the eggs don't overwinter. The eggs actually will freeze during the winter. So even the ones that survive in an egg sac, they actually, the little eggs will embryonate and the little baby spiders will hatch out of their eggs, but stay in the egg sac and just hang out there as little baby spiders until the weather is right.
Okay, now I saw, the reason we gave you a call this time is I saw this big international report, spider researchers from like, I think 20 countries looked in the media and they like tracked down things that were wrong that people were saying about spiders. As somebody who studies spiders yourself, do you see a lot of kind of misinformation or misunderstandings of spiders?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. That's a big part of my job, is to reassure people and make sure that spiders are not on their top 10 or even top 100 list of things to worry about.
Yeah, one of the interesting things in this study was the places where they have the most dangerous spiders, like Australia, they're pretty calm about it. It's places like, you know, the UK and some places here in the United States, too, where we don't have a lot of dangerous venomous spiders that the media tends to freak out more. Why do you think that is?
That's been my experience too. I grew up in New Mexico, and I could find 50 black widows in my backyard in New Mexico. And yet here, if you find a black widow, you know, it's a news story. And so I think that's what it is. It's unfamiliarity makes people kind of nervous and worry about things. And I think the more you know about these animals, the less you realize you have to fear from them.
Now, a common misunderstanding, again, according to these international researchers, is a lot of people will show up at a doctor thinking they have a spider bite, and it probably isn't. And I got to admit to you, I have been that person in my life. Mm-hmm. Spider bites apparently are way less common than we think they are.
Yes, absolutely. I think in general, you have to compare them to wasp stings, right? Has anyone ever asked you, hey, is this little red mark a wasp sting? No, because, you know, you look down and there's a wasp stinging you and it really hurts. And that's essentially the way it is for most spider bites, too. You will know if you get bitten by a spider because you will see a spider biting you. And so you don't have to wonder if you see a little red mark. That is very unlikely to be a spider bite. And there's so many other things that it could be. But spiders just get the blame.
Now, we heard on Facebook from Jimmy, who writes, the three things that scare people most are spiders, snakes, and bats. Now, Jimmy has a theory. Jimmy says this is because they have one thing in common: unpredictable movement. Other creatures are predictable. Most likely, they'll simply run in a straight line away from a person. These three don't. They're kind of all over the place. So what do you think of that theory of scary creatures?
Yeah, he might be onto something. I think there's something about spiders being kind of sneaky, and you often don't notice them until suddenly you do. And so there's that. I think the number of legs, you know, the legginess of spiders, I think is very, you know, very deeply negative to some people. So it's kind of hard to say what it is, but there's definitely, it's about us. It's not about them. It's a psychological issue, and not so much an issue of them being dangerous to us at all.
Now, this is a pretty common part of human psychology, being scared of spiders, that yet you are, Mike, somebody who's devoted your life in part to studying spiders. What is it that captured your attention and your imagination?
You know, I think seeing them under the microscope had a huge impact on me, because they really are amazing looking. I would say they're really beautiful looking, but essentially it's like some kind of a tiger or something. But the only reason why they're not in zoos everywhere is because they're so small. And so they really are a fascinating group. They use silk as a technology to accomplish almost all of their problems, to solve, you know, solutions to all their problems. And so in some sense, they're almost more interesting than a tiger or a lion because they've got this sort of unfair tool that they use, silk that they use to make webs and do all sorts of other things with as well.
How do they do that? How do they produce? I mean, silk production, it took humans a long time and we had to use the natural world to do it ourselves, really. How do spiders do it?
It is amazing. We've learned what genes the spider uses to make the silk, and we can get bacteria to synthesize the silk, but the silk does not make a spider web then. It just makes this gloppy stuff. And so it's how it comes out of the spider's abdomen, out of the spinnerets, and how it gets kind of combed by the spider's legs that produces the alignment of molecules, and it produces this incredible tensile strength and elasticity, which really exceeds any man-made material. So that's the way they make it. And so they can do something that we can't do, quite frankly.
We're listening back to our talk with Michael Draney, biologist at UW Green Bay, about some of the big misconceptions about spiders. In just a bit, we'll hear more of that conversation and find out what spiders mean for the mosquito population here in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, talking to Michael Draney, biology professor at UW Green Bay, looking at spiders, facts and fiction about them. You can share your thoughts or questions, or maybe your love of spiders or fear thereof, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. On Facebook, Brandy writes, "I like spiders a lot, and I try not to kill them. If they're where I don't like, then I catch and release. My husband thinks it's dumb, but hey," Brandy says, "they eat mosquitoes, so they're cool in my book." Mike, how about spiders eat a lot in the way of mosquitoes in Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been estimated that around the world, the weight of the insects that spiders consume every year exceeds the weight of humans living on the planet
Wow.
at that time. So they make a massive difference in the kinds of insects and the amount of insects that you find, not just in Wisconsin, but all around the world.
Now, what are some of the most common kinds of spiders we see around the state? I don't know that I could tell them apart, really, but what are our most common spiders here?
Yeah, it's interesting. The most common ones and the ones that people see the most are not really the same, right? Because in order to be conspicuous, they have to live by us and they have to be large. So people are very familiar with wolf spiders. They're hairy and kind of earth tones and they run around. People are familiar with jumping spiders. They live on our houses and they jump around. But there's a lot of tiny spiders that live in leaf litter that there's twice as many species of those. There's over 100 species of sheetweb spiders that live in Wisconsin, and yet few people have ever really seen one. So those are kind of two different questions. But yeah, a lot of the big web spinners are becoming adults right now, and those are the ones that people notice around Halloween.
Right, and not all spiders spin webs. Do I have that right?
That is right. Yeah, all spiders make silk. And a lot of them use their silk to wrap their eggs in. They use silk as a little drag line, so in case they fall, they don't fall all the way to the ground. So they do all sorts of things with silk. You've probably heard they balloon. They can travel long distances as babies, especially, using silk lines. But webs is just one thing that they've evolved to use this amazing material for.
Are there more rare spiders that you're always too happy to hear a report of in the state?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Everyone's always saying, oh, you study spiders, you can come to my house and there's a million of them in my basement. But, you know, of course, those are the ones that are very common. And there's oftentimes they're not even native to the state. They've been moved here and they like our houses because they're sort of like a cave, right? A cave in the tropics or a cave in the Middle East or something. So those are not the spiders that particularly make me happy. It's the spiders that live in rare habitats in Wisconsin, old growth forests, unusual wetlands. Those unusual habitats are going to have unusual denizens, including spiders. And sometimes we find spiders that we've never found in Wisconsin before. Not that they're new species necessarily, but they're maybe more common in Canada or maybe more common down south. And those are the ones that really make me excited to find.
We've talked about eating mosquitoes a bit. Can you talk about the role of spiders in these ecosystems you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, they are definitely predators. That's what all spiders are doing. They're eating different spiders will eat different kinds of insects, and they're not all out there, you know, just trying to help us, right? I mean, clearly we're not really part of their world. They they're eating insects to survive and to do what they do. But not only are they eating insects, they are food for all sorts of other animals, right? Including a lot of animals that we really appreciate. Great example are songbirds. So we always talk about how songbirds are eating caterpillars, and that's true. They feed their babies caterpillars, even if they eat seeds. But most of those songbirds will switch from caterpillars to spiders for about a week during the nesting of their babies. And it's at a time when the brain is growing. And the reason is because spiders have more of an amino acid called taurine in their bodies than caterpillars do. And this taurine is really important for brain development. So it's kind of like brain food for birds. And so these spiders actually, by feeding spiders to baby birds, the baby birds grow up more inquisitive and braver, more curious and more intelligent.
Now, one thing that I used to think I got corrected on, I think at an early age, spiders are not insects. Who are they most closely related to? Who are the closest cousins in the animal world to the spiders?
Yeah, so spiders are arachnids, and these are animals that don't have jaws. They have either fangs or pincers for their mouth parts. And some of the close arachnids that live in Wisconsin, we have the mites and ticks, not everybody's favorite animal, but ticks are arachnids. We've also got the daddy long legs, which actually are not spiders. They don't have any silk. And then we also have farther south, not in Wisconsin, all sorts of scorpions, wind scorpions, and sort of related animals that live, especially in drier parts of the world and in the tropics as well.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Michael Draney, professor of biology at UW Green Bay. We talked with him about one of his specialties, spiders, and some of the misconceptions we might have about our eight-legged friends. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. In the U.S., we look to Scandinavian countries sometimes for a lot of inspiration for interior design, high happiness levels, Legos, the ultra-cozy lifestyle concept called hygge. There's also a less well-known concept there that's been big for generations, friluftsliv. And it's all about embracing the outdoors, no matter what the conditions are. Linda Ukesson-McGurk is a Swedish-American writer, author of the parenting memoir There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather. Her latest book is called The Open Air Life, Discover the Nordic Art of Friluftsliv and Connect with Nature Every Day. I talked with her about it last week. Can you introduce us to this concept of Friluftsliv? I've seen different translations. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, so like hygge, it really lacks an equivalent in the English language, but I tend to translate it as open air life. That's a rough translation. It's about spending time outside in the natural and cultural landscape for personal wellness, but also to experience nature without pressure to achieve or compete. And to me, that's what really sets it apart from just any outdoor recreation. There's no competition. You can just just be in nature and just be one with nature. It's a more mindful way of connecting with the natural world.
And you write that you grew up with this in Sweden. Can you talk about what that looked like in your own childhood?
Yeah. So this is really ingrained into our culture, and it starts early. It starts when we're babies, and our parents and daycare providers leave us outside to nap in the strollers. And just as you get into preschool, you also spend hours outside. And then you end up spending a lot of time with family too, just doing different friluftsliv activities like walking, hiking, camping, foraging for berries or mushrooms, cooking outside, all kinds of outdoor activities, but centered around your nearby nature. So it's very much rooted in local tradition, and it's something that is passed down from one generation to the next. So I have a lot of positive memories from spending time outside, both with my parents but also grandparents. So it's not unusual for like three generations to be out walking and hiking together on the weekends and so forth. So That's how I grew up.
One thing I love about the concept as you write about it is I think sometimes we might think of, yeah, once this year I'm going to go on a big trip to a big national park in the west of the country, or, you know, even a long camping trip in the state park. And those are great. But you say the first step is, you know, we could be as close as our backyard or a park down the street. Tell us how to find that free loose leave where we live.
Yeah, exactly. I think because the type of the green spaces that are near you or near your home, they're the ones that you can actually use on a daily or a near daily basis, and they're going to make a huge difference to your life. So as you say, I think it's definitely great to have those big trips if you can get away to a wilder space every once in a while. That's fantastic, but try to look around. I think we tend to forget sometimes about our local communities and the green spaces that are actually available, and try to work that sort of into your regular routines. If you have a backyard, that's a fantastic place to start. Maybe having cookouts, or even going to like a local park if you have one within walking distance. I think what friluftsliv does is that it really hones our ability to also to notice nature in all its forms, even in the city. So it helps us notice the birds, for example, because birds live everywhere, even in the city. So it puts, I think, the whole concept of nature more on a spectrum rather than it being an either or, if you see what I mean, like, sure. In the city too, even the weather around us, that's part of nature too. All the forces that we can't control. So the rain that falls on our forehead, that's another way of experiencing nature, really.
And I wanted to bring that up because I've changed over my life. There was once upon a time I would say, yeah, I love getting into the outdoors if the weather's nice. And then having kids made me more willing to get out in bad weather, and COVID even more so. Your mindset, I think, and the free loose leave mindset is, there is no such thing as bad weather.
Yes, that is an important cornerstone of friluftsliv, actually. It is that you try to enjoy nature and the outdoors and in all kinds of weather in every season, and that you actually find something to like in every season. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you have to love love the cold or love the rain. But I think most people, once you actually reframe it and change your mindset, you'll notice that you feel good outside, even when the weather is a bit challenging. And there are days when the best part of going outside is coming back inside. I'm not going to be shy about that. I mean, that's the truth. But I think experiencing those contrasts also, that's part of what makes our lives richer, I think. It makes us appreciate the warmth of home more when we've been outside and on a really, really cold day. It's nice to come inside and warm up and have a hot drink. And, there's just something to that.
We're talking to Linda Ukesson-McGurk. Her new book is The Open Air Life: Discover the Nordic Art of Friluftsliv and Connect with Nature Every Day. Linda, as an American reading your book, the most amazing thing to me was something you've got there in Sweden and some of your neighboring countries. If I'm hiking there and I come across private property, I can keep going by law. Can you talk about the priority that your country has placed on access to nature, even if somebody else owns it?
Yes. So we have something called allemansrätten, which means the right to roam. And it's sort of based on this idea that nature is something, or the land is something, that we maintain together, regardless of whose name is on the property deed. So it's something that we all can access. And it's pretty extensive. It goes to not only can you walk on private property, you can forage for berries and mushrooms. You can set up camp for a couple of nights without asking a landowner for permission. You can even have a small campfire unless there's a fire ban in place. You can ride a bike most places, ride horses even. does not apply to like your backyard, right? You can't just like pitch a tent right outside somebody's house, but it does apply to land where there's no dwelling in the immediately nearby. So obviously that gives us a lot of land to access, and it really facilitates an open air life. And it is a pretty unique. And I didn't realize that until I started traveling more and started going places where you encounter, you know, no trespassing mm-hmm. signs. Whereas in Sweden, it's actually illegal to put those signs up because most places you can't, like there's no you can't trespass because you have the right to go through other people's property, which I know is an outlandish idea to a lot of Americans. It's very different, but yeah, that's how it is here.
We don't have that here, but we do have parks. And I wanted to ask, one of the people you talk about in your book was someone who had gotten a job for the government, and his job was to find parks in a city that they could close and develop into land. And he started studying who used parks and what they meant for people. What did he find?
Right. He found that people used it, both the elderly and children, and they, you know, the daycares used parks for taking the kids to, and the elderly used them as well. And what amazed him the most was that nobody had really cared to find out. They had just decided to develop these parks and put buildings on them without even recognizing that anybody used them. And that was back in the 80s. And of course, a lot has happened since then. Back then, the whole concept that being in nature is good for our mental health, it was kind of I wouldn't say non-existent, but it was in its infancy, those thoughts and the research around it. So of course, when he started questioning, you know, well, why are we going to develop these spaces that are actually really meaningful to people? Then he was able to actually save those parks. They ended up not developing them once this research came through. And that just goes to show that it's a lot, you know, even if we feel in our guts that it is good for us to be outside, a lot of times it takes that research to, you know, we need to have the facts to back it up. And that changed the course of all the those parks and the development that could have been. And to this day, those parks are still there. So it was very good for the city.
And leave us with some inspiration about the benefits of freeloseleaf, of getting outside and enjoying and contemplating and existing in nature.
I mean, there are all the physical benefits of being physically active outside, which freeloseleaf is about. I mean, look at all the lifestyle diseases today, or the big ones. I mean, we got cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes. Being physically active outside helps prevent all of those, or reduces the risk for all of those, and as well as stress and anxiety. Depression is another huge issue today, and we know that nature is very relaxing and helps us feel good. And so you know, it's just really good for that, for those reasons. But I to me, it's about something else too. And I always say this too, it's about finding joy out there. I think that's just as important. I don't go outside thinking that, oh, you know, today I'm going to go off and like reduce my risk of getting osteoporosis when I'm 70. I go outside because it makes me feel good, and because it's a great way of connecting with your children or your parents, or, you know, across the generational divides. It is just a wonderful meeting place, and to connect with friends as well, especially over, you know, over a meal, over the fire, or going for a walk, you know, whatever you choose to do outside. I think it really helps bring people together, and it helps us connect with the other world as well, the natural world, of which we are an important part, of course, as well.
Linda, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Linda Åkesson-McGurk, a Swedish-American writer and author. I talked to her last week about her latest book. It's called The Open Air Life: Discover the Nordic Art of Friluftsliv and Connect with Nature Every Day.